Court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, United States v. Carlisle. Mr. Williams.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Williams. I am an attorney from Indiana, and I have represented defendant and appellant Eddie Lamar Carlisle in the district court, trial court, and also here for the appeal. Mr. Carlisle was charged in the indictment for two counts of possession with intent to distribute in count one, cocaine base or crack cocaine, and in count two, marijuana. He ultimately pled in May 2009 to the first count in a conditional plea, expressly reserving the right to appeal the adverse ruling in the opinion and order on the motion to suppress, which is the basis for our appeal. And that's why we're here. As I review the opinion and order, I found two points that I wanted to bring out. One is I believe that there's a factual error, and I believe it's been brought out in the briefs. But in the opinion and order, the court actually did take the time to recite some of the dialogue from the motion to suppress hearing between the government and defendant Mr. Carlisle. And there's discussion on the record about what Mr. Carlisle actually said at the hearing, which is he admitted that the bag was not his, and he admitted that he told the officers he did not know what was in it. But it's very important to point out that at the time that the bag was opened, the time of the search, Mr. Carlisle, in fact, did not disavow ownership. He did not say that the bag was not his. In fact, the first time he ever said that was at the hearing on the motion to suppress. And the reading of the transcript from the hearing makes that clear. It appears in the opinion and order that the trial court felt that Mr. Carlisle had actually admitted that at the time of the search, back at 4015 Lily Street on February 18th, 2008, that he said, "It's not mine." In fact, he never did anything like that. Indeed, he didn't go ahead and answer any questions of the officer, Officer Snyder in this case, until after the bag had been opened, because the sequence of events is that Mr. Carlisle exited the house on Lily Street at a time when other police officers were at the front. He exited the rear. Officers are at the front. He exits the rear. There are two officers in the back of the house who stop him. They see him with a bag in his hands. He complies. He follows their orders. He gets down on the ground and places the bag at his feet. The police officers state that they're concerned for officer safety, and they handcuff him and take him back inside the home. They frisk him. They pat and frisk him, and the search yields no weapons. The district court found in the opinion and order that Mr. Carlisle had no access to the bag while he's inside the home, presumably because he's handcuffed and because he's surrounded by police officers, one of whom outside the rear of the home had pulled his taser, and he didn't need to pull his gun because the other officer had his firearm. So Mr. Carlisle is inside the home. He has no access to the backpack. There can be no concern for officer safety at this point. He's handcuffed. He's surrounded by police officers. And yet, with no additional knowledge, Officer Snyder simply opens the bag. And it's consistent with what Officer Snyder had testified to under penalty of perjury, that we were there to do a narcotics investigation. And it really does bear repeating that there's almost two kinds of investigations going on there that day. The first one is, and the government repeatedly refers to it as a consent search. Probationer Mr. Chapman lives in this home. He certainly is subject to community corrections coming in at any time and checking him out. In the short appendix, we also included the consent to search and seizure form, the resident roster form. The people who lived in the house had a duty to sign their name and consent to search and let the police, you know, cooperate with the police if they came in. Mr. Carlisle was not a person whose name was on that list because he didn't live there. What the police should have done is once they determined that Mr. Carlisle was not, in fact, Mr. Chapman, he was not the probationer, he was not an individual whose name was on the consent form or the search form, the resident roster form, they should have let him go. And there was no probable cause to justify the search of the bag. The government characterized the search as a protective sweep. With all respect to the trial court, I believe it was a legal error. The trial court, in the opinion and order, actually appreciated the government's characterization of the law of protective sweeps and appreciated it enough that the court almost verbatim took the verbiage from the government's motion in the opposition to the motion to suppress and adopted it in the opinion and order discussing Cady v. Sheehan for the proposition that a protective sweep can include looking into the briefcase that someone has in their hand. But, of course, our case is factually distinguishable from Cady because in that case, Mr. Cady was not cooperative. He would not confirm his identity, and he had a briefcase that he kept going into. He kept opening it, pulling out papers, and going back in, so the officers had a real concern about officer safety that is absent here, where Mr. Carlisle immediately complied with all demands. He confirmed his identity. The bag was opaque, and it was never open. In the Cady case, we might even have some plain view considerations because if the briefcase is open and closed several times, you could partially see into it. Respectfully, with all due deference to the trial court, I believe that was a legal error to expand what the law of protective sweeps is all about. Much has been said on this issue of the reasonable expectation of privacy, and I understand that that's a very, very big issue. As I read Amaral Estrada, of course, the law is that the defendant has to exhibit an actual or subjective expectation of privacy, which society recognizes as reasonable. The cases that I see where people failed, for example, in Rawlings, which, by the way, was a warrant case, different from our case since there was no warrant. In Rawlings, a man had to admit that he didn't really have much expectation of privacy in a woman's purse. But this is quite different. Mr. Carlisle has a bag. It's called a backpack-style bag or maybe even a gym-style bag. There's no reason why he would not have an expectation of privacy. And even the police associated this bag with him and even brought the bag into the house with him. They associated
with him. The association doesn't yes. give him the expectation of privacy in the inside of that, does it? It's sort of like a UPS driver. UPS delivery guy doesn't have an expectation of privacy as to what's inside the packages they drop off. They belong to someone else. They have a mission with them, but they don't have an expectation of privacy on the contents, do they?
Your Honor, I think I agree with you on that. As I see it, the association by the police of the bag with the defendant really goes to the second prong. This is something which society recognizes as reasonable. They associate it with him. The subjective expectation of privacy, many of the cases I read are about people who are in a car and the item is in the trunk or it's in the glove compartment or they're on a train or they're on a plane and it's in an up compartment above them. Here, the first prong, the subjective expectation of privacy, is that it's in his hands. It's a personal right. It's on his person. So I believe that the both prongs are met. By the white light, I think I'm getting into my rebuttal time, if I may step down.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
Mr. Geller?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Anthony Geller for the United States. I suppose just jumping off the last couple of things that Mr. Williams was saying with regard to reasonable expectation of privacy, the main flaw with the defendant, with the appellant's argument in this case, is the fact that he never asserted, never established, and never proved that he had a subjective expectation of privacy. I mean, the test is, it's more or less a two-part test. First, you have to show an actual or subjective expectation of privacy. And the second half is that expectation must be recognized by society as being reasonable. So you have both a subjective and an objective component. His problem is that he's never established a subjective component at the scene, and he wants to use cases like Bond, for example, to show that, well, the government is stuck with what the officers knew at the scene. But that's not true at all. The defendant, the appellant, is the one who has the burden of establishing and proving the reasonable expectation of privacy. And there's a lot of cases, Rim and some of these other cases, that recognize that oftentimes the person must present an affidavit or must present some evidence or testimony to show what their intent is. I mean, you may have an apartment situation where you have a lease or something like that. It's not quite as critical. You can present the lease and maybe not necessarily present testimony. But where you have a bag like this, it's almost necessary to present testimony that, yes, that is my bag, or there are these other circumstances that show that I have an intent to maintain privacy in that item. And that was simply not done in this case. For example, in the Bond case, that involved a suitcase, and the defendant in that case initially disclaimed ownership of the suitcase, and sort of one thing leads to another. Cash is found. He disclaims the cash. And then the fellow's name is actually found on the suitcase, at which time he admits that it's a suitcase. So, in essence, that is what gets him in the door as far as the subjective component of the test is concerned. And that's not what happened in this case. At the scene, the defendant, Mr. Carlisle, basically says that I picked up the bag from inside the house and I was taking it outside. And then he's denied any knowledge of the contents of the bag. And that's it. That's all we have.
He had ownership, too.
I believe at the scene he neither claimed nor denied ownership at the scene.
It's later that he says it's not his bag.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's actually at the hearing that we have on the motion to suppress where he much more affirmatively denies any claim to the bag. He testifies, well, he reiterates the stuff that happens at the scene. He reiterates the fact that he was picking the bag up and taking it outside to the garage. He says that the bag's owner is Mr. Chapman. He says that Mr. Chapman directed him to do that. At no point in time during the hearing does he testify regarding knowledge of the contents. He doesn't say anything about any ability to exclude others. He doesn't even really say that Chapman gave him permission to look in the bag. And he affirmatively says that, no, it is not my bag at the hearing. And that eliminates his ability to even challenge the search because he has not established the subjective component of the test.
Was the bag opened in his presence?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the understanding that I had from the testimony. Yes. And then it's thereafter that he's asked questions and after Miranda. And then and I won't dwell on this, but even if he did have an ability to challenge the search of the bag, you know, there are issues of consent and the protective sweep. As far as the consent is concerned, you know, the Melgar case and some of these other cases cited in the brief, in essence, if the bag came from the house, any doubt as to whether that bag goes with the house, in essence, inures to the benefit of law enforcement. And certainly Mr. Carlisle's statements provide that inference, that the bag came from the house, that he was simply taking it outside. So we have that. As far as the protective sweep or the weapons frisk of the bag more or less is concerned, I would just sort of remind the court from the brief that we have a situation when that bag is first brought back into the house where the officers don't even know if the officers in the front are in yet. The house has not been swept for people. They don't know who else is in the house. They don't know what other danger points arise. And even if a person is handcuffed, that person may still have the opportunity to get into that bag. The best strategy for the cops, and which is what they did in this case, is simply to eliminate the threat right then and there by frisking, in essence, the bag and ensuring themselves that there are no weapons. The other aspect of the appellant's argument, I think, is he alleges that the officers lacked reasonable suspicion to stop the appellant as he came out the back door. And, of course, with this test, common sense is what sort of drives this totality of the circumstances test. And I think you can't divorce that situation from the context. You have a home detention participant who is on home detention for drug dealing. There is quite a bit of information, recent information, even surveillance from that day, corroborating tips and those sorts of things that shows that this is an active drug house. So then the officers, in essence, go to perform a home detention visit that same evening. So that's the context that we're there. The officers form a perimeter, and the officers in the back are in essence remaining sort of semi-hidden or hidden behind a garage, and they know that there is there are officers at the front who are trying to make contact with the occupants of the house, trying to get in to perform the consent search. The officers in the back see somebody peeking out at least four times through the blinds out the back windows. And, of course, the officer's estimation that somebody was trying to see if the coast was clear for an escape. Then we have the defendant, the appellant, Mr. Carlisle, who pops out the back door. He looks quite deliberately to his left and to his right, and he starts to run, essentially towards the only avenue of escape. He doesn't take the sidewalk, and then the officers immediately draw a taser on him and have him get to the ground. So all of those factors, I mean, these things just simply scream the fact that there is somebody trying to make their way out the back with some sort of prohibited item, be it drugs, be it weapons, or even somewhat more of an innocuous prohibited item like alcohol, which home detention participants cannot have. So I think quite clearly when you think about the context of that situation and the defendant's actions that there is most certainly reasonable suspicion to investigate whether or not Chapman has violated the home detention order or whether somebody else has helped him do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Mr. Williams?
Your Honors, the government talked about how frisking the bag was essentially what happened with this protective sweep. If they had actually frisked the bag and felt the outside of it to see if there were any objects that felt to them like a gun, perhaps that would have been acceptable. They didn't do that here. They actually just went ahead and opened it. "I just opened the bag," said Officer Snyder. I do like the Bond case. The Bond case talks about what controls are the facts known to the police officers at the time of the search. And there's an acknowledgement by the government that there was no knowledge by the police at the time of the search. They don't know until they confirm Mr. Carlisle's identity, even who he is. But the officers at the rear of the residence certainly don't know anything about what's gone on at the front of the residence, and at the time of the search, nothing has been found in the house. I thought I saw perhaps a question, Your Honor. There was a reference to consent. There's certainly no consent here by Mr. Carlisle. This was excessive as a protective sweep. And again, the subjective expectation of privacy in this case is certainly distinguishable from the Rawlings case, where Mr. Rawlings apparently had a woman's purse and Mr. Carlisle had a bag that would be associated with a man.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Thank you, Mr. Keller. Mr. Williams, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting the appointment and ably representing Mr. Carlisle in this case.
Thank you very much.
Case is taken under advisement.